They walked on for days, continually encountering meadows of constantly changing plant life. It was as if a different strain of seeds had been planted on every hill. The flowers and vegetation were evolving in isolated little fields of their own. They passed roses with petals as big as baseball mitts, red and green, beautiful, fragrant, and ringed with inch-long poisonous spikes. Daisies of black and blue, mixtures of pastel gray and maroon, mauve and ember, dark and beautiful in the white light of the rising moon. Roxanne kept the lead as he always did when on the move, always looking ahead into the darkness beyond the line of sight. His eyes spotted something ahead and slowed the free fighters down with a wave of his right hand. The ground ahead seemed to be shimmering with a strange, wavering fire. He walked closer now. Whatever it was, it didn't feel dangerous. Before him lay a large circle of constantly shifting white light, a good 100 feet in diameter. As Rock walked closer, he could scarcely believe his eyes.
Good God, it's alive!
The phosphorescent circle of light was moving with rippling energy. Millions of tiny glowing larvae, worm-like creatures with one eye as big as a penny and bodies that throbbed like a heart from light bulb dim to flash bulb bright. They pulsed in patterns, sending waves of light and shadows across the living pond. The rest of the attack force gathered behind Roxanne, who stood about 30 feet away from the living organism.
What the hell is that?
No, Detroit, stay away. They're an insect of some sort, but I wouldn't get too close. That pack has to feed on something.
Have you ever seen anything like that?
No, never. McCoughlin, I think it's a totally new life form.
They watched. Suddenly, a forest animal darted near the edge of the glowing organism, opposite from where the free fighter stood. A pseudopod of the glowing larvae snapped out from the pond and up to the bank, bringing the deer-like creature down instantly. It was pulled back into the throbbing pool and sucked down within seconds into the glow. The millions of larvae now throbbed as one, like a great searchlight flashing on and off. After about 10 seconds, there was calm. The light seemed to dim suddenly and lose energy. The luminescence calmed to a dull glow.
It ate. Now it's sleeping.
Yeah, just like a human.
General Mikhail Zhabnov peered at his ruddy, fat face in the mirror held in front of him by a trembling barber. The general's black goatee had been well trimmed. His ruddy cheeks had been smoothed, and his thinning wisps of blonde hair were combed straight and flat across his nearly bald pate. Oily the way he liked it. Scented.
Your work is adequate, barber. That is all.
The barber simply nodded and stayed to clean up after himself. Zhabnov wore his bright olive uniform, pressed sharp as a blade, and the twin golden emblems on his collar, an eagle carrying a hammer and sickle in its huge claws, the symbol of his rank. He strode toward the door stiffly, sucking in his gut, raising his broad shoulders. The guards that were present everywhere in the well-preserved White House saluted as he exited the barbershop, located in one of the many complexes that ran deep beneath the ancient building. From these offices, General Zhabnov ruled America, sending out commands, gathering records and proof of shipment of crops to designated ports for transport back to Russia. It was a huge bureaucracy that had existed and grown for nearly a century, until it was as fat and complacent as a slug. And it ran itself, which was just fine with Zhabnov, who didn't want to be bothered with paperwork. He stepped out into the west wing hallway leading to the Oval Office. Zhabnov was always slightly awed by all the portraits of the past presidents of the United States, Eisenhower, Lincoln, Kennedy, Reagan, and their Soviet successors, and the huge, haunting portrait of Washington. He had been banned from removing any artwork by Premier Vasily, who had vetted its pricelessness and historical value. Zhabnov glared back up at the portrait as he stepped by. Damn thing took up the whole wall. As he walked up to the door of the Oval Office, another Russian guard snapped to attention. Zhabnov walked to the presidential teak wood desk and collapsed into his chair. Aside from the present occupant, the building and grounds were still exactly as they were before the war. Washington hadn't even been targeted, except for four neutron bombs strategically dropped in Chevy Chase, Hyattsville, Hillcrest Heights, and Arlington. The Reds wanted to rule America from the same headquarters the Americans had. It would make the transition that much easier. Besides, the American president had been off in Oregon, cutting a ribbon for a new dam. That whole state was just layer upon layer of overlapping craters. The Soviet generals had gone mad in their fear that somehow the American president would survive to lead the United States in a counterattack.
Yes, sir.
Give me Gilov.
Home or office?
Office, office! Do I ever call my friend at home? Do you think I want to talk to his maid, his cook? Idiot! His office, of course!
Yes, sir. Sorry. Yes?
Gilov, it's the president. We've got to talk.
Then talk.
Well, it's this little matter I have before me on my desk. I just got it, actually. And I thought I would call you about it so it could be straightened out before it got into the hands of the Premier.
Oh, so you have only just received the urgent request I sent days ago to stop these scum who have attacked our forces with impunity. The army doesn't seem able to handle it properly.
My staff downgraded its importance. I've been occupied with important matters for days.
Downgraded the report on clandestine resistance bases?
Downgraded the speculation you sent me about these so-called free fighters.
I assure you, Mr. President, these Americans are much better armed and equipped than you can imagine. Several patrols have simply vanished without a trace in Colorado and Utah lately, and others are being attacked with increasing frequency.
And you think this is the result of resistance fighters? It was probably some of our green soldiers making a wrong turn in a magnetic storm, or got themselves eaten by those toothy American wolf dogs.
Mr. President, wolves don't make off with all the ammunition and medical supplies.
So these patrols fell down some crevasses or died in one of those sandstorms. Kilov, you are too excitable. The Premier, I know this for sure, I talked to him in person at his granddaughter's wedding in Minsk only last month, wants to limit military action. You must get out in the fresh, clean air of Mother Russia more. The Premier pulls me aside at the reception and tells me, "Nephew, please," he is so polite, "please don't use any more atomic weapons in America. There is enough radiation in the world." Now, is that not what you are planning to do, Commander Kilov? Use those enhanced radiation neutron devices?
Small atomic devices. Flashes of radiation that only destroy life and rapidly diminish in a few days.
Kilov! No more radiation! That's what the Premier wants. He is a conservationist, an ecologist, a humanitarian. We can't go dropping atomic bombs on the few ragged—
Mikhail Ivanovich Zhabnov, just do me one favor. Bring it to the attention of the Premier that we may not have a United Socialist States of America for the centennial next year if I am not able to discharge my duties.
Your duties are intelligence, Kilov. Intelligence, counter-espionage, and internal security. You have expanded your function, with my and the Premier's permission. You have expanded your Blackshirt force to over 500,000, with, I must say, a tremendous budget. Do I not let you send in your death-head paratroop commandos to destroy these wretched Freedom Brigades? Which, as I'm sure you know, many of the other generals do not appreciate at all, considering it a usurpation of their authority. And now you want still more. Can't you do the job without pulverizing the country that feeds Mother Russia?
Approach the Premier. Tell him I need more troops, more weapons, if he is against using these neutron weapons. We have a situation here in America. A critical one.
Zhabnov let the KGB leader sweat for a minute as he admired the bright cherry redness of the roses that surrounded the White House. They almost disguised the barbed wire fence that ran through their delicate petals.
I'll tell you what, my friend. I'm attending the annual party meeting in Leningrad next month. I will personally intervene with my uncle at that time and persuade him you need more of everything from...
Including the neutron devices, Jatta.
Including a few, two or three neutron devices to destroy these annoying American bandits once and for all.
Thank you, Mikhail Ivanovich. I will, of course, repay you for this favor.
Zhabnov had no real intention of letting the KGB expand its operations in the United States. It was already too large, a threat to the normal military channels and control. He knew he would find a way to keep Kilov in check. Kilov paced back and forth in his office, a cold, stark, ultra-modern gray and white affair. He wore the tight black uniform of Sinleather, emblazoned only on the collar with the insignia of his rank 5 red stars and the KGB Red Death's Head. He stared out the window at the mist-shrouded Rockies off in the distance. From the 80th floor of his KGB command building in Denver, he could see a good 40 miles when the day was clear of the dust storms or the mists. Kilov glanced down at the request for the use of atomic weapons he had received back from Premier Vasily in Moscow, a big Niet stamped on it in red. Premier Vasily was about to let it all slip away and permit these mutant Americans to take over the world. And he would somehow have to defend that fool Zhabnov from being overrun by the rebels, so when the time was right, there would still be a White House standing. Kilov stopped pacing. How many rebels were out there? 10,000? 100,000? There were disquieting rumors that the technology of some of these hidden Americans surpassed the finest in Russia. Then why were they hanging back? Why didn't they attack? Kilov knew the reason. They were growing stronger, while the Russian Empire was growing weaker, more decadent, and more complacent every day. As the morning sun began its weary ascent through the pink clouded skies, Roxen raised his right hand. They had found a grove of very dense palm-like trees that surrounded a pool of cool blue water. The men would be happy to be resting for a few hours. McCaughlin made a crude fishing pole from a birch branch and twisted a safety pin he used to hold his constantly splitting pants together into a hook. He probed around in the dirt until he found a big, juicy black beetle and skewered it with the pin.
Ah, fishing. That's my style. Hey, looks like I got a bite. Ooh, looks like a big one.
Something broke the surface, whipping wildly. A horned, multi-eyed, ten-legged, green, scaly creature, nearly 2.5 feet long, with a row of spikes running the length of its back. It shook and whipped its head this way and that, trying to free itself from the safety pin hook, solidly embedded in its snapping jaw.
Whoa!
That's ugly! I don't care if he's ugly or beautiful. I'm gonna eat the sucker!
The green fish thing came flying from the water straight up at him, snapping rows of razor-sharp teeth. The biting 60-pound thing flopped on the sand, twisting its hard body around violently, biting at everything in sight.
Damn, he's mean.
Come on, boys. It ain't right to torture living things. That's for Russians.
The now headless fish twitched a few times and then went still. The men walked over to examine it, still a little cautious. Up close, its teeth looked even more formidable. 5 rows going back in its mouth, each row containing nearly 30 hooked, razor-sharp teeth. The front row had a set of fang-like protuberances almost 5 inches long. Equipped with fins and a tail and 10 little feet with small claws, the creature looked somehow peculiar, as if it was really made up of several different animals, wrongly sewn together.
It's a strange one, that's for sure. Been fishing this part of the country my whole life and never seen one like this.
Bet he don't taste too good. Might as well throw him back.
Hell I will, Berger. I'll cook this baby up right now, and you can just diddle your machine gun while we dine, for all I care.
And with that, McCaughlin went to his pack, pulled out one of the smokeless stoves the free fighters carried, and set to cooking his catch. A half hour later, the men were all digging into the fish.
Damn thing's delicious. Best I ever ate.
Boys, you got the best fisherman this side of the Rockies with you. Don't you know how lucky you are?
Hey, pass me a foot.
Hell no. They're the best part. I caught it. They're mine to eat.
They had been feasting for about half an hour when Roxon felt the air change. It grew cold suddenly, electric. He looked up at the churning gray sky and saw the green clouds.
On your feet, men. Double time. There's an acid storm coming. We've got 5 minutes at most.
The free fighters dropped their meals where they stood and ran for their supplies and the hybrids. Everyone had experienced these storms before. The green-clouded storms pulsing with electricity that appeared out of nowhere and swooped low to the earth, releasing a putrid rain of radioactive acid that meant death for anyone caught in its downpour. The men herded the hybrids together and made a circular barrier with their packs and weapons. They quickly pulled out the aluminized tarps which every man carried. Compact, able to fold up into a compartment in their packs, the tarps could expand a 20-foot square to create a momentary haven of safety. Aluminum was one of the few substances that could resist the dissolving powers of the acid rain. The attack force quickly created a little lean-to, zipping four of the tarps together and hoisted it over their group now bunched together. They tied the ends of the silver tarps to four trees, and not a moment too soon. They pulled down the shiny flaps on the sides of the tarps so they were completely enclosed in the metallic covering. Bunched tightly together, they could hardly breathe in the instantly sweltering enclosure. The hybrid's foul breath, strong-smelling bodies, neighing and shifting made the space a madhouse of activity. The storm increased in fury, pounding down on the tarp, while the men sat, their hearts pounding and their lips dry, in the near darkness of the enclosure. Several of the hybrids tried to rise, but the man nearest them would poke them in the nose with a fist or pull their ears back until they calmed down. The tarp above their heads sagged and rippled with the acid water of the storm. It was a severe one with high winds, and the entire structure began shaking. But suddenly, there was silence outside. They waited about 10 minutes for the drops to dry and then carefully peeked outside. The area that had been directly hit by the acid drops was in shambles. Trees, vegetation, all wilted, were eaten away with brown and black holes as if burned by fire. Several animals lay dead, their bodies lying at strange angles, legs and necks broken and cracked as the tormented creatures had tried to outrun the excruciatingly painful drops, flailing their torsos so powerfully that they literally broke their own bones. A deer lay near the pond, its flesh still smoking, its head burned almost entirely away. Nearby, a skull attached to a charred black body was all that remained of some other luckless forest dweller. The men shuddered, said a silent prayer of thanks for their own survival, and carefully replaced their supplies. They folded the tarps, first carefully shaking out the few drops of the vile rain that had not evaporated, and packed them. One of the hybrid horses had somehow gotten a few drops of the acid on its shoulder. Pasquale, the medical man of the attack force, got some ointment from his pack, and after gouging out the affected area with a scalpel, salved the raw flesh of the hybrid. It would survive, it just wouldn't have hair in that spot ever again. They headed off into the brush again. According to Rock's calculations, they should be emerging from the main part of the forest by the next day. Then just a quick run across the mountains and home again, in Century City. The men were in a good mood. Things had gone relatively well this trip, except for the dead, but there were always dead on a strike. They all knew that death lay just around the corner. When it came, there was nothing any man on Earth could do to stop it. Death was the one certainty in a constantly changing world. Rock kept the lead, pushing forward through increasingly dense growth and thorns, hacking at it when it became entangled around his khaki pants with his 12-inch bowie knife. The moon rose full, shining like a ghostly eye in the dark sky, lighting up the harsh land below. The woods were thinning out now, and Rock knew they couldn't be too far from the other end. Ahead, Roxon spotted a clearing, and he surveyed it swiftly. Crouching low, he moved forward through the trees, edging along the shadows, so as not to reveal himself in the bathing rays of the now purple moon. Something was out there. He edged closer, taking out his 12-gauge rapid-firing shotgun pistol that held 6 shells and 2 in the chamber. the blast of which could take out two or three Russians at 20 feet. Roxen moved on his toes, his weight perfectly balanced, his ears perked to the most silent of sounds. He peered around a thorny bush, his pistol held high in his hand.